Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Outbreak conference call. As a reminder, today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. Jeffrey Levy. Please go ahead, Mr. Levy.
Thank you very much. Good morning, everyone. I am Jeff Levy, Executive Director of Trust for America's Health. Thanks for joining us today for the release of Outbreaks, Protecting Americans from Infectious Diseases, the third annual version of this report, which we are co-releasing with the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. I'm pleased to be joined today by one of the country's leading experts on emergency preparedness, response, and health crisis management, Dr. Dan Hanfling, contributing scholar at UPMC Center for Health Security. The full report and state-by-state materials are available on our website, www.healthyamericanswithans.org. I'll start by providing an overview of the findings in the report, then hand the call over to Dan for some important perspective on these issues, and then I'll go over some of the key recommendations from the report before we open up the call for questions. We conduct the Outbreaks report to examine the country's policies to respond to ongoing and emerging infectious disease threats, including new threats such as MERS-CoV and antibiotic-resistant superbugs, as well as resurging illnesses like whooping cough, gonorrhea, and tuberculosis. Most infectious diseases are preventable, but we found overall that we haven't made the investments required to put in place many of the basic protections that could help avoid significant numbers of outbreaks and save billions of dollars in unnecessary healthcare costs. The country's interest in infectious diseases tends to ebb and flow. When there's a new scary threat, like Ebola last year, there's a major ramp-up, but once there's a sense that an outbreak is contained, we fall back to a place of complacency. In the meantime, we never sufficiently address many persistent and deadly problems that could be avoided. We conduct the Outbreaks report to help assess policies and the capacity to protect against infectious diseases. The report highlights a series of 10 indicators in each state. It is not a comprehensive evaluation, but they are all important bellwethers, and taken collectively, they offer a composite snapshot of strengths and vulnerabilities across the health system. We found that 28 states and Washington, D.C. scored 5 or lower out of the 10 key indicators. 5 states, Delaware, Kentucky, Maine, New York, and Virginia, tied for the top score, achieving 8 out of 10 indicators. 7 states, Idaho, Kansas, Michigan, Ohio, Oklahoma, Oregon, and Utah, tied for the lowest score at 3 out of 10. This is a note for reporters who may have seen an embargoed version of the report. The Oklahoma score was adjusted based on newly received information. To review some of our key findings in the area of preparing for emerging threats, while there have been significant advances in preparing for public health emergencies since the September 11, 2001, and anthrax attacks, many gaps remain. Insufficient resources have led to 15 state public health laboratories not having a biosafety professional on staff. Labs are essential for detecting, diagnosing, and containing outbreaks, including potential acts of bioterrorism, but they must be able to do this safely. Only 15 states have completed climate change adaptation plans, which includes planning for the potential impact on human health. In the area of healthcare-associated infections, around 1 in every 25 people who are hospitalized get an infection while receiving care. We found that last year only 9 states were able to reduce the number of one significant form of these infections contracted through central bloodlines. Vaccinations are one of the most important ways to contain many diseases, but we found only 18 states vaccinated at least half of their population against the flu last season. Each year, up to 20% of Americans get the flu, and depending on the severity of the strain, it can lead to anywhere between 3,000 and 49,000 deaths. Rates are particularly low among young and middle-aged adults, at 38%. In terms of childhood vaccinations, I'm sure many of you have heard about the resurgence of diseases like measles and whooping cough in some communities and states. Last year, there were more than 600 cases of measles and nearly 33,000 cases of whooping cough. While more than 90% of kindergartners have received their complete vaccinations, we're still seeing pockets of communities where the rates are much, much lower. In addition, more than 28% of preschoolers do not receive all their recommended vaccinations. We found that 20 states either exclude philosophical exemptions entirely or require a parental notification or affidavit to achieve a religious or philosophical exemption for school attendance. This helps ensure more children receive recommended vaccinations and communities are better protected against outbreaks. As you probably have also heard about, there's been a troubling new hepatitis C epidemic, mostly in young adults in rural and suburban areas in some states in the East and Midwest. Infections have increased 150% between 2010 and 2013 and are related to, at least in part, to people who have become dependent on prescription painkillers who start using heroin as an alternative. We must get this problem under control quickly before it continues to increase and spread. One of the most proven effective ways to help prevent the spread of hepatitis C infections is through syringe exchange programs. But we found that only 16 states and Washington, D.C. explicitly authorize these programs. We've recently seen a number of states experiencing heroin and hepatitis C taking action in this area, including in Kentucky and Indiana, which have started allowing some community-based syringe exchange programs. I should also note that the omnibus budget bill now making its way through Congress would modify the ban on the use of federal funds for exchange programs in communities fighting HIV and hepatitis C epidemics. There have been promising new advances in strategies to better contain the spread of HIV and AIDS, but still there are more than 1.2 million Americans living with HIV, and around 1 in 8 of those individuals do not know they are infected. And there are still troubling rates of new infections among young gay men of color. We found that 43 states and Washington, D.C. require reporting all detectable and undetectable HIV viral load counts as well as CD4 cell counts to their state HIV surveillance programs. This is an important way of measuring whether treatment that prevents the spread of HIV is being effectively delivered. Another area where we looked at is food safety. Around 48 million Americans get sick from a foodborne illness each year. Early detection and tracing the source of outbreaks is essential. Last year, 11 states did not meet the national goal for testing for E. coli outbreaks, which require testing 90% of E. coli 0157 cases within a 4-day window. Finally, one of the scariest threats we look at is antibiotic-resistant superbugs. While antibiotics have been one of the most important advances in fighting infectious diseases, their overuse has contributed to the emergence of antibiotic-resistant strains of diseases. More than 2 million Americans contract a superbug each year, leading to 23,000 deaths, $20 billion in direct medical costs, and more than $35 billion in lost productivity. So with that overview, I'll turn the call over to Dan Hansling, who's contributing scholar at the UPMC's Center for Health Security, to give more perspective on the country's infectious disease prevention approach.
Thanks very much, Jeff. From superbugs to salmonella to the seasonal flu, infectious diseases cost the country around $120 billion each year. Fighting infectious diseases requires constant vigilance, but this is a lesson that we tend to forget and tragically continue to relearn. Past successes in fighting diseases due to vaccines, antibiotics, and vigilant public health practices have been dramatic, but they have contributed to a lack of urgency and insufficient support to maintain and grow the defenses that we need to adequately protect the public. Last year's attention in the United States to the Ebola outbreak is a prime example. It resulted in ephemeral attention and attempts to quickly backfill gaps in our emergency health preparedness through emergency supplemental effort, support, and efforts. And this year, it seems like a distant memory to many. And in its aftermath, we are only now getting down to the harder job of ensuring that we have a system in place that is ready when new infectious threats emerge or that makes a dent in many ongoing and serious infectious disease problems in the country. From a real-world perspective, from having been on the front lines of the anthrax attacks and response in 2001 to being a part of the team addressing Ebola and what we correctly anticipated to be its arrival on U.S. shores last year, I've seen over and over again a pattern where we fail to sufficiently invest in and sustain many basic defenses against infectious disease threats. Disease outbreaks, whether they start as an act of Mother Nature or as a result of bioterrorism, can be hard to predict, but the one thing we know is that they are inevitable. There was a lot of work that was done in the wake of the September 11th and anthrax attacks to think about how to improve our preparedness for emergency health threats. Lots of progress has been made, including that emergency physicians and nurses and public health professionals are truly first responders, or what now we like to term first receivers. Back in 2001, when two U.S. postal workers with inhalation anthrax presented seeking care to our emergency department in Northern Virginia, we had to develop the wheel. we had to put together ad hoc systems of information management, communications across the health system, developing treatment protocols and procedures, and a host of other activities, including the important focus on the development of healthcare coalitions that have been built upon over the last 14 years. But unfortunately, some serious gaps still remain, and some of the progress that we've made has eroded as we've lost a keen sense of urgency. That lack of urgency is mirrored in the country's complacency to really trying to tackle a range of ongoing problems, where if we took greater action, we could make huge dents in reducing everything from HIV/AIDS to the seasonal flu. For instance, we still don't have a strong and reliable plan in place to be able to provide care to a major influx of patients during a widespread outbreak, such as a pandemic flu or a localized bioterror event. Surge planning needs to push towards the next level, the ability to deliver crisis care to large numbers of patients who may need advanced and complex treatment capabilities. We aren't quite there yet. As a result, or probably because of the fact that we aren't sufficiently investing in developing the next generation of vaccines and antiviral medications, potential for additional disease persists. And the nation lacks a real-time interoperable infectious disease surveillance system, something that is critically important for us if we are to know that we are at risk. This report helps build a pathway for optimism and moving forward. There's no way for us to prepare 100% for every possible scenario, but what is clear is that there's a lot we can do to create a baseline of achievable goals to at least maintain a core baseline of protection around the country to reduce the threat and havoc that infectious diseases can create. The question remains to be seen if we will take the right steps forward. With that, I'll pass the call back over to Jeff.
Thanks very much, Dan. I'll conclude by going over some of our major recommendations in the outbreaks report. We have many more available by specific issue within the report as well. To improve the prevention and control of infectious diseases, we must increase resources to ensure every state can maintain and modernize basic capabilities, such as epidemiology and laboratory abilities, that are needed to respond to new and ongoing outbreaks. We have to update our disease surveillance system to be real-time and interoperable across communities and health systems to better detect, track, and contain disease threats. We must incentivize the development of new medicines and vaccines and ensure systems are in place to effectively distribute them when needed. We need to decrease antibiotic overuse and increase vaccination rates, and we need to improve and maintain the ability of the health system to be prepared for a range of potential threats, such as an influx of patients during a widespread outbreak or the containment of a novel, highly infectious organism that requires specialty care. And we need to strengthen efforts and policies to reduce healthcare-associated infections and take strong measures to contain the rising hepatitis C epidemic and other sexually transmitted infections, particularly among young adults. And finally, we need to adopt modern strategies to end AIDS in every state and city. We must never forget the threat that infectious diseases pose, and we must get beyond our focus on new and exotic emerging concerns and get down to the business of preventing and controlling ongoing disruptive diseases. If we do that, we'll not only reduce the rates of persistent problems, we'll also be better able to respond when a new threat emerges. With that, let's go ahead and open up the call for any questions, and just a reminder that the report and state-by-state materials are available on our website, healthyamericans.org. Operator.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on the phone line will indicate when your line is open to ask a question. Please state your name before posing your question. Again, press star 1 to ask a question. We'll pause for just a moment to allow everyone an opportunity to signal for a question. Please stand by. And we'll move to our first question from Lisa Schering of SIDRAP News. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks so much for being available for this today, and I always look forward to your reports. I'm just wondering what you see as new this year in terms of just how the nation is doing overall. Is there anything surprising that you found in how the states did? When I compare last year's report, it kind of looks like some states did better, some states did worse. But just wondering what major changes stood out to you and if there's anything surprising. Thanks so much.
Sure. I don't think there was anything dramatically surprising in this report. I would say what is of ongoing concern is the real need to create the infrastructure that is needed to support a solid response to infectious diseases. I would say, you know, one of the major signs of progress at the federal level is a strategic plan that the CDC has developed to create a modernized infectious disease surveillance system. That said, we are a long ways from having the resources to actually build it and implement it. And so I think the ongoing challenge that we see is that on a year-to-year basis, states and localities are still depending on inadequate resources to maintain their capacity and somewhat outdated approaches to surveillance. I don't know if there's anything you wanted to add as part of that overview, Dan.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff, and thanks for the question. You know, I think focusing on the Ebola threat last year also, I think, has provided an opportunity to raise awareness and highlight the concerns, the very concerns that were outlined in this TIFA report, with some, I think, some progress slowly being made. For example, HHS's Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response and the CDC and three academic institutions, Emory University, University of Nebraska Medical Center, and Bellevue Hospital in New York, have come together to co-lead what is called the National Ebola Training and Education Center. And this is really intended to fund, train, prepare other U.S. healthcare facilities, not only for Ebola, but more generally for emerging infectious threats. So I think that is definitely a big change from, you know, from 2014 to the present time, with the opportunity to sustain some of the efforts that were put in place as a result of the Ebola scare last year.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, I think that is definitely an important addition, but I think one of the other challenges that we face is this is a really good example of learning from Ebola and trying to put new systems in place. But one of the challenges we experienced last year in Ebola that from a policy level has not been solved is that it took a long time for the emergency money that was appropriated by Congress to actually get in place and be available for states and localities. And to some degree, a lot of that money started flowing after the emergency was over. This allowed states and localities to sort of make up for some deficit and also to invest in building their systems going forward. But we haven't solved that policy level problem of making emergency resources available in a timely manner.
Good point. Thanks.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star, then digit 1 on your telephone keypad. Please state your name before posing your question. We'll move to our next question. Please go ahead.
This is Sarah Wallen from MedPage Today. I'm curious, do you guys have any concept of how much it would cost to reach appropriate levels of protection and prevention? Or implement what all your dream list here of implementation.
We do not have a specific dollar figure attached to these, but I do think we do know, and you can look at some of the fund. If you look at some of the funding history that is in the report, you will see that the overall investment in preparedness has not been steady. And to some degree, you know, so going back to earlier levels of investment would certainly be very helpful. But I think what's also important, and again, we'll see what emerges in this omnibus bill, is that the level of investment from the federal government in support of states, and the truth is that most preparedness and infectious disease spending does come from the federal government, that what we've seen is an unpredictability in that funding. And when there is unpredictability in funding, it makes it very hard for states to hire the appropriate people and to build the systems that really make a difference. And if we had, you know, maybe multi-year funding, but also moved towards a steadier state and more predictable state, that would make a big difference for states and localities in terms of their building capacity.
Yeah, and this is Dan. I would just add that, you know, as orange has become the new black, you know, flat with regards to funding has become the new up. You know, I think, states and awardees for preparedness funding are, you know, looking at flat funding as a victory when, in fact, really what it represents is an erosion of funding from 10 years ago. And you know, is a challenge because these, your question is spot on. These are expensive fixes to make, and we need to make these in a sustainable fashion so that the recognized return on investment is benefited 5, 10, 20 years henceforth. And that's hard to do with flat funding.
Yeah, and different programs have had different levels of, quote, success in funding, and you can see the details on pages 47 and 48 of our report, but just to highlight two, you know, the funding that for state and local health departments around preparedness in recent years peaked in fiscal 2010 at $760 million and in fiscal 15 was at $681 million. The other program that I think Dan is particularly familiar with is the Hospital Preparedness Program, which in fiscal 15 was down to almost $255 million. But, you know, at its peak, which actually goes way back to, you know, fiscal 2007 was $474 million. So it's hard to build that kind of build and sustain capacity with those kinds of fluctuations in funding. Did that answer your question?
Oh, yes, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you. Once again, ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. There are no further questions at this time. Please continue.
All right. That concludes our call. I again want to thank Dan Hansling from UPMC Center for Security and all of you for joining us. A reminder that the report and the state-by-state materials are on our website, healthyamericans.org, and will be available throughout the day for any additional questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this does conclude your conference call for today. We thank you for your participation. You may now disconnect your lines and have a great day.